a caravan of Muslims, a nationalist president, and an energized electorate, all celebrating the fifth anniversary of the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With Trump stepping up his attacks on the press, is the future of one of America's institutions in jeopardy? Marvin Kalb shares his thoughts.
I am very unhappy when I say that a president of the United States, by his action and his words, cutting into the essence of what an American democracy is supposed to be.
Plus, the two candidates running for the Senate in Arizona hold a nasty and personal debate.
Kyrsten Sinema, during a media gaggle, said, you know, this is ridiculous. She's just taking my words out of context. McSally, after the debate, when she was asked, did you really mean to accuse her of advocating for treason, said, absolutely I did.
And do the ethics questions hovering over New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez remind anyone of Robert Torricelli 16 years earlier?
Even after he stepped down, he continued to want to be a player in New Jersey politics. And if the word was that if Menendez was convicted and forced to step down, that he was available.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 249 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It's the fifth anniversary of The Political Junkie. We began this endeavor back in October of 2013. We actually started this program because of our love of politics. But let's face it, not everyone is loving politics these days. People are not happy, and they haven't been for a while. President Obama's job approval back then was not much different than where President Trump finds himself today, with one big difference. The kind of appeals to voters we are seeing from the president are nothing like we've ever seen before. One issue Trump clearly feels is helping the Republicans, and he may be right, is the so-called caravan of Hondurans and Guatemalans who are marching through Mexico with the hope of entering the United States, something Trump vows not to let happen.
The Democrat Party is openly inviting millions of illegal aliens to break our laws, violate our borders, and overwhelm our nation. Democrats produce mobs. Republicans produce jobs.
These are hardened criminals. These are tough people. And I don't want them in our country.
And what kind of president would use the suffering of others to make a political point?
You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist.
Whether Trump's familiar approach to these issues will succeed or not is still unclear. We've long known that Democrats are fired up about this year's midterms and have been for some time. But polls are now showing an increased number of Republicans energized about November 6th as well. As of now, with 2 weeks to go, and remember, our track record on predicting has not been stellar lately, it looks like the Democrats will be picking up at least the necessary 23 seats to give them a majority in the House. But the Republicans may even add to their majority in the Senate. And what would be the message to come out of that? I guess we'll just have to wait and see. The midterms also lead to this week's trivia question. Democrats are expected to do very well in the nation's 36th gubernatorial contest this year, if for no other reason than the numbers they are faced with. 26 of the seats are held by Republicans, with many of them retiring because of term limits. Only 9 are held by Democrats. And there's also one independent in Alaska, but he just dropped out of the race. So the question is, what state has gone the longest since last electing a Democrat as governor? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. It's a staple of every Trump speech at every rally.
These are just dishonest, terrible people. I'm telling you that. Terrible people.
The enemy of the people, and they are.
Because they are the fake, disgusting news.
Every president has had his battles with the media, but no one, until Donald Trump, called the press the enemy of the American people. It's a tactic that could lead, has led, more and more people to simply distrust what they see on TV or what they read in the newspapers. America's faith in the media, never great to begin with, is continuing to fade. The danger, of course, is not only a lack of trust, it's that others will begin to see the media as the enemy as well, literally. Saudi Arabia is well known for that, so are Russia and China, and alarmingly, so are more and more Americans. Kenneth Vogel, a reporter with the New York Times, got this message on his telephone answering machine.
You're the problem. You are the enemy of the people. And although the pen might be mightier than the sword, the pen is not mightier than the AK-47. And just remember, Ken, there's nothing civil about a civil war.
Is this something to worry about? Is it a threat to democracy? Marvin Kalb says yes. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution and a former reporter for both CBS and NBC News. He's an astute observer of the media, and he's written a new book, Enemy of the People, Trump's War on the Press, the New McCarthyism, and the Threat to American Democracy. Marvin, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much, Kent. Be delighted. Delighted to be with you.
Well, thank you. And you know, Marvin, we haven't even started talking yet, and I'm already depressed. but you know, let me before we get to Trump, even in your book, it's a great book and it's a great read. You spend a lot of time in your book discussing the rise of Joe McCarthy. You argue the case that, quote, the comparison between McCarthy and Trump is unmistakable. Make that case for us.
Well, I think in a way it's easy. If you go back into the early 1950s, there was Senator Joe McCarthy, Wisconsin. He was a Midwestern hardline Republican, and he was very frustrated that he was not being recognized as the great man that he thought he was. And he was trying to think of a way in which he could attract reporters' attention. That was the beginning of the Cold War. And he came up with the idea that if he said that there were communists in the government, at the State Department, at the White House, at the Pentagon, that there were communists in Hollywood making our movies, that there were communists in New York writing our newspapers, he could get a lot of attention that way, and that is exactly what happened. But the effect of it was to produce such fear in the American society. So many people lost their jobs because somebody said, whoops, there goes a communist, that McCarthy seized on that as proof that he was the right man for this moment. And he even had his eye on the presidency, but there was a guy standing in the way named Eisenhower. And what's interesting, Eisenhower himself, even though he was so popular with the American people, was in many ways afraid to take on McCarthy. And he was afraid to take on McCarthy, and all of the Republicans up on the Hill were afraid to open their mouths about McCarthy because they feared McCarthy would call them a communist. And so the use of the press in this ugly, diabolical way, the fear that he injected into the American people and the American political establishment, the idea that a senior American politician would find inspiration not in the U.S., but overseas in the communist world. That struck me as odd. Up until you make the comparison with President Trump, and then it's not odd, it's consistent. It's the new McCarthyism.
You know, you talked about people who did, you said that Eisenhower was afraid or just failed to stand up to McCarthy, at least publicly. But we do know that there were people like Margaret Chase Smith and Edward R. Murrow and Joseph Welch and others who helped bring down McCarthy. One thing I'm thinking of, though, his fall didn't happen until 4 years after he made that famous speech in Wheeling about the, you know, the X number of communists in the State Department. But for a long time during his reign, or some people say reign of terror, he was aided by a press that loved to report on everything he had to say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is really something that links McCarthy and Trump even more closely, because McCarthy was great copy. Trump is great copy. What McCarthy said was picked up and used by reporters, and that information was put above the fold in newspapers, and it led radio newscasts at the time, even some of the television programs, because McCarthy was hot. He was great copy. Reporters used him as a way of getting on the air. And that's pretty much what happened in the 2016 campaign and ever since with President Trump. He is hot copy. He is good stuff. He is going to allow you to get onto the front page of a newspaper and to certainly lead your evening newscast. Sometimes it doesn't even matter whether the president or Senator McCarthy in his day said something newsworthy. It was simply the fact that he said it in the way that he said it, playing on the fears and anxieties of the American people for many different reasons. That led to reporters believing that these guys are terrific copy and I'm going to write about it no matter what. And that was, in my judgment, that was terrible journalism. And it took a small group of reporters led by Edward R. Murrow of CBS to really go after McCarthy in those days, and a number of reporters today, to try to get at the truth of Trump. It's a difficult, difficult chore, but it's a necessary one.
Speaking of Murrow, he hired you at CBS, didn't he?
Yes, he did. June 1957.
Well, let me point out some things that doesn't make sense to me. I mean, Murrow helped expose McCarthy, and he was finished. Woodward and Bernstein helped expose Nixon, and he resigned. Now there are daily exposés from the New York Times and the Washington Post and others almost every day that would have ended the presidency of anyone else. The lies, the dealing with Russia, a cabinet filled with ethics problems, how he lines his pockets, you know, comments about women and Muslims and immigrants and Hispanics. It's not that we don't know of this. We do, and the press does too. They report it every day, and yet, if anything, Trump's numbers are improving. I don't know why.
Well, one of the reasons, Ken, is that the press of Murrow's day was significantly different from the press of today. The press has undergone a technological and financial revolution since that time that makes the entire thing quite different. In Murrow's day, there were really three major networks, and really two. ABC had not yet caught on. But there were very few, and there were a couple of major news magazines and many excellent newspapers, but that was it. And so if Edward R. Murrow said something on air in prime time, that was big stuff. That was hot stuff. That was, and many, many people believed Murrow because of his reporting from World War II. So he was a phenomenal journalist. He was a pioneer. People believed him. When Walter Cronkite spoke about the Vietnam War in 1968, and Lyndon Johnson was afraid that if Cronkite went against the war, he would have lost Middle America, as he put it. One of the reasons that Johnson was afraid was that Walter Cronkite had an 83% trust factor with the American people. There is no journalist today, no anchorman today, who would get even a fifth of that kind of a rating. The entire concept of the relationship of the public to the press has changed. And now people are distrustful of the press. suspicious of it. When Murrow spoke, people believed him. When Cronkite spoke, people believed him. Not today. There is no Murrow today. And if there were a Murrow today, he would not be hired.
Well, in addition to there not being a Murrow today, I also feel that I've never seen a president like Donald Trump before. And I think Leslie Stahl put it the best. She was part of a panel a few months ago, and she explained exactly what's going on. She was talking about an interview she had with Trump before he became president. Listen to what she says.
At one point, he started to attack the press. And it's just me and my boss and him. He has a huge office. And he's attacking the press. And there were no cameras. There was nothing going on. And I said, you know, that is getting tired. Why are you doing this? You're doing it over and over, and it's boring, and it's time to end that. You know, you've won the nomination. And why do you keep hammering at this? And he said, you know why I do it? I do it to discredit you all and demean you all, so when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you.
Marvin, it's working, isn't it?
Oh, I think it is working. And I was just thinking and listening to that, there's a larger factor at work here as well. In talking to Leslie, Trump was giving you a political tactic, a political shortcut to trying to get his way. However, what he doesn't understand, in my opinion, is that when you demean the press, you are demeaning one of the anchors of American democracy. I remember Murrow once saying to me that there were two fundamental pillars to American democracy. One of them was the sanctity of the court, and the other was the freedom of the press. That if you have both, you will have your democracy. If either one of those is damaged and weakened, you weaken the entire structure of democracy. And that is the reason, by the way, that I wrote this book, Enemy of the People. I wanted very much to point out that it is not just politics. You are cutting to an underlying fundamental principle of our democracy when you rip apart the press. I'm not saying that you have to be a CBS viewer as opposed to a Fox viewer. Put that aside. I'm talking about the entire concept that there be a free press able to stand aside and watch the politicians and say, hey, wait a minute, that isn't true. You said this last week. Now you're saying something different. That is the role of the press. It is to speak truth to power and let the American people understand that. That was the reason that I wanted so much, although it was very painful to do, I must stress that. I wanted so much to finish this book because I felt the central point had to be made at this time.
Well, so tell me, what did this all add up to? You have a president who attacks the press. You have a president who dumps on American allies, but not on Putin or other autocratic leaders. He calls for the imprisonment of his defeated rival, you know, lock her up. What does that all sound like to you?
Well, unfortunately, what it sounds like to me is some similar politicians in the 20th century. I don't want to make an easy, cheap linkage between President Trump and some of the dictators of the 20th century, but I must point out the history, that in history, you have to look at fact. In the 1930s, in Germany, a leader rose by attacking the press, attacking them, attacking foreigners, attacking Jews, attacking journalists, attacking writers, anybody who was an easy target. That led within a very brief period of time to the establishment of a Nazi dictatorship in Germany, which was up to that point a very sophisticated, modern industrialized society. In other words, if you look in history, you find unhappy parallels with governments that were equally democratic as the United States is today, and yet things can happen. Democracy is not written anywhere in concrete. Democracy is a word. It only has power if people believe in that word. And at this particular point, I am very unhappy when I say that a president of the United States is cutting into, by his action and his words, cutting into the fabric, the essence of what an American democracy is supposed to be. And you, if you lose some of that, there's no guarantee that you get it back. People have said to me, well, when Trump leaves, we go back to where we were before. No, no, not necessarily at all. I have a feeling that what he is doing is powerful and has resonance, and I fear for that resonance and the impact that it may have.
And what do you make of the Republican Party? You know, during Nixon, for example, you had Republicans like Howard Baker and Barry Goldwater and John Rhodes and others who saying enough is enough. Today, there's really none of that. You have, you know, Jeff Flake talks a good game, but he ultimately capitulates. Lindsey Graham doesn't even talk a good game anymore. What's happened to the Republican Party?
Well, it's the same kind of thing that happened during the McCarthy period. When there is a fear, a deep fear of an important colleague, and in McCarthy's day, he was the colleague, and he had all of the Republicans terrified. You mentioned earlier Margaret Chase Smith. McCarthy started speaking about the communists at the State Department, 270, he said, something like that, at the State Department in February of 1950. On June 1st, as I recall, in 1950, this freshman senator from Maine decided to talk against McCarthy. And there were five others, Republicans who joined her. None of the others did. Within a matter of a year, she was regarded as somewhat odd because she did something that no other Republican did. We find an unhappy comparison with the Republican Party of today. There are many Republicans, you mentioned Flake, many others, I think, who are quiet now because they are concerned about their political status. They're concerned about overall the Republican Party. Many of them simply don't like Democrats, period. Whatever the explanation is, they are essentially silent. And that silence is dangerous. If somebody is doing something that deep in your gut you know is wrong, or at least potentially damaging to the country, stand up and say something. But they're not. And that is a shame. It is a shame.
In your heart, you know he's wrong, right?
That's right. That's
well,
right.
Let me add a personal note. I mean, and you and I were talking about this before we went on the air, but I think this is something that I almost want to end this interview with. I've spent some 35 years of my life in journalism, and I know you've spent a lot more, and it's never been our job to express opinions about a president, and I don't think we've ever done that. Although, you know, we've both covered rogues and demagogues and bad guys. And part of me feels that I failed in being this outspoken and in discussing my personal views, but I don't know what the alternative is. I can't imagine staying silent.
Let me tell you, Ken, and this is a difficult confession for me to make. You spoke about 35 years in this business. I've been in this business now for 65 years. And in that period of time, I have reported the news. And I think most people who watched or listened to me felt that I was giving them essentially as close to the truth as I could. And that was my intent. And that is what I did for most of my life. When Trump came along and used the expression enemy of the people to describe the American press, my mind went back to Nikita Khrushchev in 1956. I was covering the Soviet Union in those years. Nikita Khrushchev said, and while he denounced Joseph Stalin as a horrible communist leader, one of the things he said was that Stalin used to use the expression enemy of the people in order to go after journalists and writers, people who were not with the party and with Stalin. And Khrushchev thought that was so awful that he said that in a proper communist society, we can never use an expression like enemy of the people. And here was the leader of a democratic country saying that. So my mind thought about a communist leader was upset by the use of that expression. And here is an American politician using it to attack the free press. And I was beside myself. I was stunned. I didn't know what to say, what to do. And then I figured that, look, I'm 88 years old. I am of an age now where I can afford to speak my mind. And I just felt that if I didn't do it now, I probably would never be able to do it. And I had to sound off. And I think that every American citizen has a personal, individual responsibility to speak truth to power. Journalists are not supposed to do that. And to that extent, I apologize. But that's my reasoning. And I want anyone who listens to understand I didn't do this joyfully. I did it with a degree of personal pain, but I felt I had to do it and did.
Marvin Kalb is a former reporter for both CBS and NBC News and the author of the new book, Enemy of the People, Trump's War on the Press, the New McCarthyism, and the Threat to American Democracy. Marvin, you've written an important book, and it was great having you on the program.
Thank you very much, Ken. Pleasure to be with you.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down.
One of the most closely watched contests this year is the battle for the Senate in Arizona. Representatives Martha McSally, the Republican, and Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat, are fighting it out for the seat being vacated by Republican Jeff Flake. The two candidates held a very contentious debate in the past week. Arizona is one of the few Senate seats Democrats think they can pick up. Yvonne Winget Sanchez is covering the race for the Arizona Republic. Yvonne, it's great having you back on the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I watched the entire debate this week and last week, and it was pretty gripping. I mean, we'll get into the specifics in a minute, but I guess what I wanted to know is, what was the race looking like before the debate, and did it change anything?
You know, it's hard to say. I think from the get-go, there has been kind of this widely held notion that Kyrsten Sinema, because she really did not face a competitive primary, was in a really good position to take this thing home. But what we've seen in recent weeks and in the lead up to the debate is just millions and millions of dollars coming from Martha McSally's Republican allies, you know, those aligned with Mitch McConnell and others, spending just so much money to really knock Sinema off her game, to cast her as a far left extremist whose kind of modulation to the center is super phony, and she can't be trusted. And so I think with the combination of all of that negative advertising against Sinema, plus her pretty scripted performance at the debate, you know, this thing is all kind of added up to a even more competitive race than what we thought it was even just a couple of weeks ago.
I agree with you. I thought that she was more scripted. Sinema was more scripted. And I also thought that it felt like McSally was more aggressive in accusing Sinema of running a dirty campaign, but at the same time, she was doing more of the attacking.
Yeah, I think McSally clearly came to talk about some very specific things, right? I mean, she's leaned into her military background and her own personal biography throughout this race. She is in a state where, you know, we just lost Senator John McCain. We all know about his service. She has really tried to sell herself as, you know, someone who has devoted her life to this country. And she is applauded and lauded wherever she goes for that. But it seems like she's having a hard time with maybe moderate Republicans and some women who feel like she's maybe too aggressive, or they don't like that she's cozied up so much with Trump. So McSally came into that debate wanting to talk about her service, wanting to talk about Sinema's past position, I think back in a 2002 newspaper questionnaire with us, where she advocated for the closure of Luke Air Force Base. And the debate never got there. She never got to talk about veterans issues. She never got to talk about the military. And so in that final kind of 90 seconds, you saw her just throw everything she had, right? Her best material at Sinema. And for some people, it just really turned them off.
Let me just give some background of what you just saying. Back in 2003, before she was elected to office, Sinema was a well-known anti-war activist. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Yeah. And she was on this radio program hosted by a libertarian, where the host offered a hypothetical about joining the Taliban, and Sinema responded with a "I don't care" or "go ahead" response. Let me listen to that.
As an individual, if I want to go fight in the Taliban army, I go over there, and I'm fighting for the Taliban. I'm saying that's a personal decision. Individual,
fine, I don't care if you want to do that.
Thought that was a go ahead, just a shrug off. But now McSally is making this a big deal. And as we heard in the debate, let me play this entire exchange. It starts off with McSally. She's shrugging off a question about climate change, and then she's going in for the kill.
I fought for to make sure that the A-10 was preserved, that we fight for Luke Air Force Base. My opponent advocated to shut down Luke Air Force Base. While we were in harm's way, she was protesting our troops in a pink tutu. And I'll tell you what, if these are not disqualifying enough, Kirsten, what came out last week, CNN reported that in 2003, while she was on the radio, you said it was okay for Americans to join the Taliban to fight you had no problem.
We're running out of time,
Kirsten,
but we have to let you
respond
to that.
I want to ask right
that.
Now whether
Please.
You're going to apologize to the veterans and me for saying it's okay
Please.
To commit treason.
We are running out of time, so we got to get a response.
Well, we need a response because she owes us an apology.
Please.
Well, Martha has chosen to run a campaign like the one you're seeing right now.
It's
where
treason.
She's engaging in ridiculous attacks and smearing my campaign. And she's just trying to cut and not share the full picture. But the truth is that I've always fought for Arizona, and I have been proud to serve our state in elected office for over 13 years. Arizonans know me, and they know my record, and I've been honored to fight for them. Martha's trying to make this Senate campaign about me, but what we know is that this campaign is about everyday Arizonans, and I'll fight for them.
We have to stop it. We have to stop it right there. We got to stop
it's
it.
It's treason. There. And she also called us crazy here in Arizona.
It's the end of the debate. It's the end of the day. It's time now for closing statements.
Treason. That's pretty strong stuff.
It is strong stuff. Now, immediately following that debate, Kyrsten Sinema during a media gaggle said, you know, this is ridiculous. She's just taking my words out of context. She even said during the debate, you know, all Martha wants to do is cut, and not tell the full picture. You know, McSally, after the debate, when she was asked, look, did you really mean to accuse her of advocating for treason, said, absolutely, I did. And then she doubled down a couple of days later when she met with the Arizona Republic's editorial board. I sat in on that meeting. It was super contentious. I think both of them went in expecting some sort of apology from the other, and neither one of them got it. You know, McSally says that she takes, even if it was a throwaway line, she takes it very seriously given her service to this country. And, you know, Sinema, again, is saying that McSally is taking her words and kind of a flippant remark to try to steer the conversation on that radio show back on track. She's taking it out of context, and that she's, you know, really run a really nasty campaign, and that she's disappointed in her colleague, McSally. And they used to work together on various issues. And, you know, where that relationship goes from here remains to be seen.
Well, when I was watching the debate, I was watching this back and forth about who was telling the truth and who wasn't. It's hard to imagine the two of them ever being friends. Let's play a little bit of that tape.
Do you want to privatize Social Security.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That is a flat-out lie. Again, we've seen these attacks for many, many years. Democrats don't have anything to run on. They're basically, you know, Republicans are throwing granny over the cliff. I mean, the voters are not going to believe this.
Well, Martha said those things, and I think this is just a pattern that we've seen through this campaign, unfortunately, that Martha has changed her opinions very rapidly when she decided to run for the United States Senate and has shown that she's willing to do and say anything to get elected.
I think what I got out of that exchange is that while McSally seemed to be more aggressive, it almost felt like Sinema just was almost matter-of-factly responded. She didn't have the intensity and anger that McSally had in almost every thing that McSally said.
Yeah, and Sinema, I think, has done a really good job of staying to script. I mean, I wrote a whole story about this a couple of weeks ago. She sticks to her talking points. She wrote a whole book about how, you know, Democrats should do a better job of selling their messages and sticking to just a couple of key ideas. And that's what, you know, she took a page out of her own book in that debate. She stayed cool. She stayed calm. She had her talking points and, you know, she was not going to get testy. She wasn't going to get heated. And she came to talk about the issues that she wanted to talk about. And she felt like she did a really good job of it. McSally, on the other hand, well, she also has been, you know, trying to stay to her own script of attack, attack, attack. Again, got really frustrated when she realized she wasn't going to get the time to really attack Sinema on that Luke Air Force Base closure and the Taliban line.
Which is what she was saving. You could see that she was chomping at the bit to talk about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was chastising the moderators for, you know, not moving quickly enough to get to those issues. And you could just see the frustration in her body language and, you know, obviously at the very end when she just went after Sinema.
One thing that I wonder if it might hurt Sinema is that she touted her reputation as being someone who often breaks with her party. Could that turn Democrats off?
You know, I think that during the primary, there were a lot of progressive, kind of more left party activist types who were really upset that Sinema has kind of is casting herself as more like a third party candidate or a moderate Republican rather than a Democrat. They are frustrated that, you know, they don't really know what she stands for, really, and they don't see her at Democratic Party events. But at the end of the day, I think they probably will vote for Sinema. I mean, if they had to choose between Sinema and McSally, I think the choice for them would be really clear. McSally seems to be having some base issues with people who wanted to see Sheriff Joe Arpaio or Kelly Ward, who's a former state senator who's very conservative. They might have been big fans of theirs and were kind of disappointed with McSally, who they view as not conservative enough, despite her like 97% voting record with Trump over the past year. So,
but they've elected moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans in Arizona. I can't think of a left-wing Democrat who's ever been elected to the Senate from Arizona. Maybe that's why Sinema has to do that.
Yeah, I mean, she clearly is trying to make a run for, you know, the moderate, independent-minded voters. And that's who both of the candidates are targeting in the run-up to the election. I think both of them are counting on, you know, their base to come home. But Sinema is going to have to pull over quite a few independents and quite a few moderate Republicans in order to win.
This is one of the biggest Senate races in the country. What's your ultimate takeaway from the debate and what do you think is going to happen?
My biggest takeaway from the debate was that voters lost out by not getting to see these candidates debate again. It took a Herculean effort just to pull off that first debate, which the Arizona Republic co-sponsored with Arizona PBS. I think voters would have wanted to see them in action again. And where this race goes, I don't know. My prediction is that we're not going to have a winner on election night. I think it'll be that close.
Yvonne Winget Sanchez is a political reporter with the Arizona Republic, and she's been following the Senate race. She can be found on Twitter at Yvonne Winget, W-I-N-G-E-T-T. Yvonne, Y-V-O-N-N-E. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. Can you feel it now?
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, in the past half century, who was the most senior woman of the House to be defeated in her bid for re-election? The answer, Frances Bolton. And it happened 50 years ago. An Ohio Republican, she was first elected in a 1940 special election to succeed her late husband, and she served until 1968, when she was defeated in her bid for a 16th term by Democrat Charles Vanek. And only one person, Del Atwood of New Glasgow, Nova Scotia, in the foreign country of Canada, had the correct answer. Del also was a trivia winner back in November of 2013. And don't forget, we still have a scuttlebutt puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. New Jersey is probably best known for its turnpike, Bruce Springsteen, and the fact that it hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate since 1972. In fact, the GOP hasn't sent a new Republican to the Senate since 1954, when Clifford Case won the first of his four races. This year, Republicans are hopeful that their Senate candidate, businessman Bob Hugin, can oust the Democratic incumbent Bob Menendez, who's been engulfed in ethics challenges. Seeking a third term, Menendez was severely admonished by the Senate Ethics Committee and indicted on federal corruption charges, but his trial ended in a mistrial last year. His disapproval numbers are growing, and his poll advantage over Hugin is shrinking. Those in Jersey with long memories harken back to 2002, when another Democratic senator, Robert Torricelli, was in similar trouble. He, too, had been severely admonished by the Ethics Committee for accepting gifts from a supporter while taking official actions that benefited him. With polls showing him losing to his Republican opponent, Doug Forrester, in an election that was little more than a month away, Torricelli announced he was getting out of the race.
I have asked attorneys to file with the Supreme Court of the United States motions to have my name removed from the general election ballot. The United States Senate.
While he insisted he was not guilty of what he had been accused of, he said he was ending his campaign for the good of the Democratic Party.
Control of the Democratic majority in the United States Senate is now an issue, and I am a part of that issue. It will not only be decided in New Jersey, but it most certainly will in part be decided in New Jersey. I could not stand the pain if any failing on my part would do damage to the things and the people that I have fought for all of my life.
Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University and a longtime expert in New Jersey politics. He's watching the Menendez situation and well remembers what happened to Torricelli. Ross, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
Well, you know, back then, back in 2002, Doug Forrester was beating Torricelli in the polls, and the Democrats knew it. So how much pressure was there on Torricelli to get out? And how badly did he want to hold on to the seat?
Well, he very much wanted to hold on to the seat. And even after he stepped down, he continued to want to be a player in New Jersey politics. And it's interesting to note, I think, that the word was that if Menendez was convicted and forced to step down, that he was available. So
he's still trying to get back to the Senate.
Right, yeah. I mean, so, you know, the urge has not left him. And he just kind of hovers around the edge of New Jersey politics today, kind of waiting for another opportunity to be a player.
Well, you know, the irony is that when Torricelli left the ballot, He was replaced by Frank Lautenberg, and they hated each other. Lautenberg had given up his own Senate seat 2 years earlier because he hated raising money, but the two of them couldn't stand each other.
Absolutely not. I mean, the animus between those two men was legendary. There's a story that may or may not be apocryphal about a plane ride from D.C. to Newark, in which the two men found themselves on the plane, and in fact in the same row of seats next to each other. And there was a lobbyist who gallantly volunteered to sit in the middle seat so that the two men just wouldn't have to even, you know, be near each other. They battled with each other on just so many areas. It was just a personality clash of the first magnitude. And, you know, in a sense, there's a lesson there about the problems that can often occur when two senators of the same party represent one state. I mean, some people have worked it out. I think, actually, Menendez and Booker, for example, have a really quite good relationship, and Booker has sort of come to Menendez's assistance in this particular race.
I remember at the time the Republicans did everything they can to not allow Lautenberg on the ballot because they put him on the ballot after the deadline was over. And they said that the Republicans said it was illegal, but the court saw it differently.
That's right. They did see it differently. And, you know, there were other people, of course, who could have filled in instead of Lautenberg. In one case, it was Congressman Frank Pallone, who they simply couldn't reach. He was headed back to Washington, and I think he was passing through a part of the state in which the cell phone reception was bad. So it happened that it fell to Lautenberg, who I don't necessarily think was everybody's first choice. And the other thing was that Lautenberg, when he made his original decision to leave the Senate, I think came to regret it almost instantly. I went to a farewell party in 2000 with Senator Leahy to bid farewell to Frank Lautenberg, and I had a chance to talk to Lautenberg, and he seemed at the time, which was, you know, very shortly thereafter he made the decision, to almost immediately have rued that decision. He was ready to come back for sure.
Well, I always thought this was a clever ad. This was put out by the Republicans after the court allowed the replacement of Torricelli by Lautenberg. In this ad, first you see a kid struggling with a test in school, and the next scene is another kid losing to his dad in a game of basketball.
Oh, man, I can't do this. I quit. Teacher?
Yes?
If I fail this test, can I have Frank Lautenberg take it for me?
Torricelli and Lautenberg are teaching our children the wrong lessons.
Oh, I'm losing. I quit. Let Frank Lautenberg play for me.
Tell your children you don't quit just because you're losing.
Torricelli can quit. I can quit. I'm not going to lose.
I love that. I love that ad.
Well, you know, it certainly did make the point.
Yeah.
You know, that Lautenberg was just ready to step in. It was for him, I think, obviously, an opportunity to make up for what was really a bad decision on his part. I mean, you know, Lautenberg really kind of got into the game, you know, with his election in 1982.
Against Millicent Fenwick, one of my favorites.
Right, right. And in fact, you know, Lautenberg was known in New Jersey politics as a contributor. And I think that he, at some point, he realized that he was as good, or if not better, than the people he was giving money to. And he decided that that he could do it, and you know, he turned out, of course, to be quite successful. He and Bill Bradley didn't get along terribly well either, but it never degenerated to the point where that it did with Torricelli.
Well, this year we also have a Democratic senator who has been accused of accepting gifts in exchange of doing favors for a friend. Do you see similarities between Torricelli and Bob Menendez?
You have to. The charges were virtually the same. The punishment was identical. And the only difference, of course, is that Torricelli never went to trial. Clearly, you know, the U.S. attorney had the goods on him, whereas Menendez stoutly defended his relationship with Solomon Melgen, the physician who was his friend. You know, he used everything from the speech and debate clause of the Constitution to the fact that Melgen was a friend and friends give each other gifts. And it was evidently enough to convince the jury that there was some reasonable doubt about whether or not what he did was corrupt.
Of course, another difference between the two of them is that Torricelli was trailing in his bid for re-election. Menendez still has a lead over Bob Hugin.
He does. And I think that in New Jersey, you just never bet against a Democratic statewide candidate for United States Senate, or in fact for any office. That the New Jersey politics sort of deserves a special niche in the Smithsonian Political History Museum for being, you know, really one of the few machine politics states that still exists. I mean, we have bosses in New Jersey who, you know, resemble in many, many respects you know, the political bosses of old.
Would Hugin have a better shot had Donald Trump not been in the White House?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, so many Democrats in New Jersey who are troubled by the prospect of having to vote for Menendez have basically settled on the mantra, a vote for Bob Hugin is a vote for Donald Trump. And that may be enough to carry Menendez through. He's going to get a scare, but I do believe at the end that these county organizations in Middlesex County and in Hudson County, in Bergen County and Essex County will come through for him. That all of the, you know, the county employees are on notice that they're going to show up on election day, and generally speaking, they do. They come through.
And the Republican curse will continue.
Right, exactly. No, it's hard to imagine, you know, what Republican under what circumstances could win that Senate seat that that Clifford Case once occupied. And I think part of the problem is that Republicans, even in New Jersey today, are not Clifford Case Republicans.
They're not even Chris Christie Republicans.
That's right.
For better or worse.
Right.
Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers and a most astute observer of New Jersey politics. Ross, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Ken. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Now I feel an emptiness right to the heart of me. But you pretend.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's hard to believe, but we're now less than 2 weeks away from Election Day. Next week, we'll review the biggest races that we're keeping an eye on and the key issues at stake in this election, along with a great panel of analysts. Be sure to listen to our 2018 midterm election special, which we'll bring you next week on The Political Junkie. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Please don't hate me. This feeling just won't go away. Now we're spending all our time caught in a fantasy. Just trying to keep in mind the way it used to be. But you pretend, and I pretend, that everything is attack.